Good morning, and welcome to We've Been Everywhere. Our speaker today is Lisa Miller. She's a reference specialist and research instructor and has worked as a faculty in the Library Department of Public Service since September 2010. She has visited Ireland and Northern Ireland five times between 1997 and 2004. And her Irish experiences were varied, from walking tours and conferences to extended research and even running a marathon, which impressed me.
Walking a marathon.
Oh, and walking a marathon. Okay. You just put the word marathon in there.
Sorry.
Today she's going to take us on a literary tour of the island. Please welcome Lisa Miller.
Well, good morning, and you are very welcome to Ireland, which is the first thing you will hear if you ever go there. How many of you have been to Ireland? More than once? Okay, good. Hopefully after you view this presentation, you will put it on your list of places to go. There are so many things that you can talk about with Ireland. I thought about history, I thought about the immigrant story, but then I thought, really what drew me there in the first place was the literature and the film. I love to watch the Irish movies just to see the place because it's so beautiful and to hear the accents and so on, and to hear the stories. So that's why I picked on this. This is a very cursory tour because of time. I have left out a lot of my favorite Irish writers. I may have left out some of yours, and I apologize if I had. People often think that I'm Irish, probably because of the hair, but all evidence points to Wales, but Irish, Scots, Wales, we're all, did I do something? Okay. they say we're all Celts under the pelt. I did not take this picture of the puffin. This is on Skellig Island and Skellig Michael, which are these two rocks that basically sit 8 miles off the coast of Ireland. This is the westernmost point of Europe. But I did take the picture that's on that quilt in the upper right, and I was almost that close to the puffin because I didn't have a fancy camera. I didn't have big zoom. It was a film camera in 1997. But they're so tame. This is a bird sanctuary, and people come there to count them and look at them and photograph them, but never to shoot them. So they're not afraid of people, and they'll just sit there very politely and let you take their photograph. And then Ken told me that I must explain the big fish that was on the flyer. This is in Belfast on the Donegal Quay. And this fish, I'm so sorry Jonathan isn't here because he would love this. This is a historical record of Belfast. So the artist has printed historic documents and maps and photographs of the history of Ulster, which is the north, the northern region, and put them together clad, that's like the fish's scales, are all these historic documents. And it's right there on the quay of the Loggan River and next to the Loggan Lookout, which is basically a place where you stand and look out over the Loggan. Don't we need something like this for Kentucky or Western? Wouldn't that be awesome?
And a chicken. Yeah.
A chicken. So Ireland loves writers, artists, poets, anyone who makes their living from any sort of creative endeavor. And they don't just put dead presidents and politicians on their money and in their public statuary. They put people they really respect on their money. So I'm going to show you some of those. So there is James Joyce on the £10 note. No, this is old money. They have the euro now. And they have some amount of say in how their euro is designed, but they can't put photographs on it anymore, which is kind of sad. They can still put the Celtic harp there, which you see on the bottom, which is, by the way, the symbol of Ireland, the national symbol. It is also the symbol of the Guinness Brewery, but in reverse. So even though it's almost a national institution, the government didn't want it to look that way, so they made them flip it, just so there's no confusion there. So I'm going to be showing you some of the statues of these people. Now, if you are an artist, a writer, a poet, musician, anything like that, and you make your living from that, you do not pay income tax up to 40,000 euro. That used to be unlimited, but Brussels stepped in and had a hand in that. But I have to tell you, if you're making 40K as an artist, you're doing well. You're doing very well. So the Irish don't just pat you on the head and say, yes, it's very nice that we have writers. They put it in monetary terms. They pay you, basically, for creating, you know, this rich culture of storytelling and music and everything, very important to them. So they highly value the people who contribute to that. And that is Catherine McCauley there on the bottom. She is the founder of the Sisters of Mercy, and I believe she's up for sainthood. I think that was the last thing I heard about her. So we're going to start our tour in Dublin. You probably recognize most of those names. Some of them you might not. Some of Ireland's most famous and infamous writers either were born here or made their home here. And of course, we start with Mr. Yeats. This portrait was painted by his father, John Butler Yeats, who was a barrister and also an artist. And this hangs in the National Gallery. I love this portrait because he just looks like such an earnest, intelligent, nice young man. This is a portrait only a loving father could paint. And all of his children did really well in some sort of artistic endeavor. There were four of them. He was a writer. His brother was also an artist. And the two sisters formed an arts and crafts cooperative for women in Dublin 100 years ago. I mean, that's quite something. They were ahead of their time. And so when he was quite old, the elder Yeats was asked what he considered to be his greatest accomplishment in life. And he said, "I am most proud of having been the father of Willie and Lily and Lolly and Jack." And what a nice tribute for a father to pay to his own children. So I want you to look at that face, look at that young man, look at his mouth, because I think the mouth, more than any other part of the face, shows your life experience, okay? Now we're going to look at him a few years on. Did you see the change there? There's quite a change. I think that is disappointment, but I could be wrong. That's what it looks like to me. He is generally referred to as one of the greatest poets of the 20th century, and he did win the Nobel Prize for Literature in 1923. He was a leading figure in the Irish literary revival, or Celtic twilight. They called it twilight because they said the sun is setting on our culture, and if we don't revive it, if we don't do something to save the language and the literature and the music, it will die. He did have a life of disappointment in his love life. He courted Maud Gunn, you know, this woman that he founded the National Theatre Society with, for 3 decades. He courted this woman, and he kept asking her to marry him. She had children with another man. She married another man. He kept asking her, kept asking her. She wisely said no. At one point, he asked her daughter to marry him. She also wisely said no. And later on, I think it was probably 50s or 60s, he finally married this other woman. I've forgotten her name. But she was big into spiritualism. So they spent their twilight years going to table rapping seances and all that kind of stuff that he loved. So I'm going to play you Mr. Yeats, reading or reciting one of his more famous poems. He did a series of radio broadcasts for the BBC in early 1930s. So I want you to note his accent. He was Anglo-Irish ascendancy, which means he was not Celtic. He was upper class. His ancestors would have been Anglo-Saxon Norman, who were granted lands by English kings who had visited Ireland and gave away large pieces of it to their friends. He's also speaking in a rather inflated style of oratory that he would have learned at school. This is your recitation voice, so this is not his everyday voice. He's also quite old here, and it's also old technology.
I would arise and go now and go with a tree and a small cabin below there, lay on apples. 9 bean rows will I have there, a hive for the honey bee, and live alone in the bee loud glade. And I shall have some peace there, for peace comes dropping slow, dropping from the vales of morning, so fair the cricket sings. There midnight's all a glimmer, and noon a purple glow, and evening full of the linnet's wings. I will arise and go now, for always night and day I hear late water lapping with low sounds by the shore, but I stand on the roadway or on the pavements grey, I hear it in the deep heart's core.
I don't care how many times I hear that. It gives me chills to know that is his voice. It's like going to the Kentucky Building and actually holding something that James Monroe signed or something. Okay, and then James Joyce in Dublin. There's a list of his major works. Irish people have a very love-hate relationship with Joyce. And if you've ever been forced to read him, you probably do too. You were forced to endure Ulysses. You have to know something about Irish Catholicism to fully understand him. And he rejected his religion as a young man. But some say that when he was older, he didn't exactly embrace it, but maybe he came to appreciate it a little bit more. So Ulysses is his modernist novel that's based on Homer's Odyssey, where Leopold Bloom does this sort of pilgrimage. He goes to visit all these places in Dublin one day, June 16th, and you can actually do this now. They have his path marked out in plaques on the sidewalk, so you can do your own Bloom's Day tour. And I was actually there one day. I was on top of a city tour bus, and I saw the people, you know, like in costume. I'm going, wait, and it was too late. So you can now do your own Bloom's Day tour. This is his statue in, I think it's O'Connell Street, actually. So now look at that, look at his posture and look at his face. What personal characteristics would you ascribe to a person who looks like that? What does he look like to you?
A dandy.
A what?
A dandy.
A dandy? What else?
He has a vision.
He has a vision? What?
He looks a little lost.
He looks a little lost. Many people would agree with you, I think. He married a chambermaid in an Irish hotel, Dublin Hotel, and then spent most of the rest of his life in Paris writing things that neither his wife nor most of the people in Ireland could understand. So many people went to Paris. So many writers went to Paris. So he looked back on Dublin. He saw it as provincial. He saw the whole country of Ireland as provincial, and he called it dear, shabby Dublin, which did not endear him to Dubliners. So okay, let me show you his nickname. The Pratt in the hat. So a Pratt is kind of an arrogant jerk, right? So these nicknames are sort of come up from the people who live in Dublin. So it's like, yeah, you're a major literary figure. We have to give you a statue, but we're going to show you what we really think of you in that statue. That is in no way a flattering statue, would you say? He does kind of look like a Pratt there, the way he's standing. So he died in Zurich and was buried there. Ireland declined his wife's offer to bring his remains home and have them reinterred in Ireland. That is a pretty clear insult, I would say. And they're pretty much saying, well, you buggered off somewhere else. You can bloody well stay there. We don't want you back. And that's precisely how they would say it. So that's Joyce. However, they also did immortalize one of his characters. This is Anne Olivia Plurabella, who represents, she is the personification of the River Liffey. And you can see she, like, her hair is all seaweed and everything. Do you want to guess what her nickname is? She's a character in Finnegan's Wake, by the way. She has the best nickname I've ever had. She's in a fountain, so it looks like a jacuzzi when it's going. And, of course, we have Molly Malone. You all know that song, right? Cockles and Muscles a lot. She actually was a shellfish monger. She was also a part-time prostitute, as you may surmise from her dress. And this statue is right across the street from Trinity College. Dubliners have no problem with that. They have no problem. They don't see that as ironic at all. And she did indeed die of a fever, as the song says, because bad shellfish are a really good way to get cholera. I was going to have somebody sing Molly for me, but that's her. Some of the nicknames I can't even tell you, really. You'll have to look them up yourself. And there's poor old Oscar. Just about everything he said, I think, seems to have turned into a quotation, but my favorite one is this. Biography adds to death a new horror. And that is true of no one like it is of him. He's had everything said about him. He was married and he had two sons, but his homosexuality was really an open secret. Everyone who knew him knew that he was. And his decision to sue his lover's father for libel because he wrote it down. He called him a sodomite and he misspelled it. And that may have been what angered him, I don't know. But he took him to court and he lost. And Oscar himself went to jail for gross indecency, went to prison for 2 years at hard labor. 2 years later, when he came out of prison, he died of meningitis. So he was a broke and broken man, many say because of that one decision. However, here he is. There's his statue in Marion Square. Now, talk about pose and expression. What is that one saying to you? What does he look like? What does he look like he might be saying to passersby? I got the last laugh. I'm still here. Maybe you can't get rid of me.
I don't care.
I don't care. Yeah. It's kind of a louche, leering expression they put on his face. But he's on, this is Marion Square, which is a really nice part of Dublin. And from where he's sitting, he's looking right across at one Marion Square, which was his family home where he used to live. And the sculpture of this, I think this is amazing. None of this is artificially colored. He traveled the world to find different colored granite to put together to make this. And you can see his ring, even his rings are gold. They look gold in this statue, but it looks like it's all of a piece. It's a beautiful piece of workmanship. I cannot tell you any of his nicknames. They're so awful. I cannot tell you, but you can look them up for yourself. And also, if you plan to visit Dublin, a lot of people think, I'll stay in a B&B outside the city and drive in. It's impossible because you can't drive because of all the construction and you can't park. There's no place to park. So what I do is I get a hotel in a central located place in Dublin and I walk everywhere. It's actually cheaper in the end and far less frustrating because Dublin is very easy to walk to Dublin. So on this square you have, I think, two, possibly three pretty nice hotels, the National Library, the National Gallery, and the Natural History Museum, which every school child calls the Dead Zoo because it's full of dead animals. And they all have taken a field trip to the Dead Zoo at some point. This is Brendan Behan. Anybody heard of him before? Probably one of the lesser known if you're not into Irish literature. And if he looks like he's just been in a fight, that's probably not far from the truth. He was that kind of guy. He described himself as a drinker with a writing problem. He joined the IRA at 14, they think. And when he was 16, he was sent to Borstal, which is like reform school or juvie jail, for attempting to blow up a bridge and a few police detectives in Liverpool. So, yeah, he was that kind of guy all his life. But he was also a reader who turned into a writer, and he took all of his personal experiences, including Borstal, into his writing. And he does not flinch. He writes the way people talk, the way people talk in prison, which may not be why, may be why he hasn't been so widely known in America. As Betty Davis said of old age, he is not for sissies. So if you don't like writers who tell it like it is, you might not like him. He was often publicly drunk, and eventually he just became sort of a caricature of the drunken Irishman, and the public turned against him. He often would come to New York and stay at the Chelsea Hotel with all the other alcoholic writers and singers. That's where they hung out. But he actually died at the age of 41 of diabetic coma brought on by alcohol. There is his statue. I have not been able to find a nickname of any kind for this statue. It might be because it's relatively new. But this is one of his really famous parts of his poem when he's talking about life in the prison, and your whole life is run by the sound of that triangle. As all of our lives are run by bells, right? School bells, church bells, alarm clock, doorbell, telephone, everything. They're all telling you it's time to do this. But in a prison, it's so much more like it's louder and it applies to everybody. So everybody, it's time to eat. Everybody, it's time to go to bed. So they've even put the triangles in his on his bench there in the park, which I think is really neat. So I couldn't find a nickname, but I did find an anecdote. He was once in Canada, and gentlemen asked him, what's an Irishman doing in Canada? And he says, well, 'twas like this, which is how a lot of Irish stories begin, or this was the way of it. He said, well, now, I was in a bar in Dublin, and it had one of those coasters, and it said, drink Canada Dry. So I thought I'd give it a shot. Patrick Kavanaugh looking very much like a poet with his little beret. And this is my favorite line from him. On Pembroke Road, look out for my ghost, disheveled with shoes untied, playing through the railings with little children whose children have long since died. And he is unique because he knew the moment that he became a poet. He was 50, in his 50s. He says, as a poet, I was born in or about 1955, the place of my birth being the banks of the Grand Canal. And that's where he sits, on the banks of the Grand Canal. They commemorated him exactly the way he asked, which I think is so wonderful. He also wrote Raglan Road, which was a poem that somebody later set to music, and a lot of people have recorded that. Joan Osborne recorded it. Do you want to guess his nickname? I don't know that that's true. I think it's his expression. He often looks severe. I don't know that he was a crank, but he may look that way. Younger writer, Connor McPherson, is a playwright. He's only 43, and he has won or been nominated for many, many literary prizes internationally. If you've ever seen a movie with Kieran Hines in it, he uses him a lot in his plays and his movies. And so I say, if you're going to read one of those, read The Seafarer, and read it at Christmas time. It's not a typical Christmas story. McPherson owes a lot to Behan. Okay, I'll just say that. He tells it like it is. His characters speak the way people speak in Dublin. And Dublin is almost a character itself in his stories because, you know, the city is just so much part of when they say O'Connell Street, Irish people know exactly where he's talking, but they can picture that in their head. And if you've been there many times, you can too. So he just, all of his plays are just, you know, run through with all these images of the city. Okay, and this isn't precisely literary, but this is for my hippies in the audience. Where are my hippies? Where are you? When I was in high school, I did not realize that Phil Lynott was Irish. His mother was Irish, and his father was Afro-Guyanese from Guyana. Or that Whiskey in the Jar was a traditional Irish song, which it is, and they turned into a rock song. But, you know, in the 70s, you couldn't understand what they were saying anyway in the lyrics. So, but they love him. They absolutely love him. This is the only statue that does not have a derogatory nickname. And he is a bass player. Do you want to guess what his nickname is? It's a good one. They love him. The ace with the bass. And he is in, I think that's either Grafton Street or O'Connell Street. Okay, moving on. Limerick and the West. This is King John's Castle in Limerick. King John, not the first, because he was the only King John, Lackland. His father was Henry II, and he appointed him Lord of Ireland. If you saw The Lion in Winter, okay, there's that Henry. And if you haven't seen The Lion in Winter, why haven't you seen him? That's a wonderful. I don't care if you don't care anything about history. See that film. It's wonderful. And this is also where the Treaty Stone is located that ended the William White War. Okay, John Millington Synge. He was not born in the West. He was born in Dublin. Again, with Yeats, was Anglo-Irish ascendancy, was not Celtic ancestry, but his literary heritage is now inextricably woven into the Western landscape. So this is what happened. He met Yeats in Paris. All these writers are always meeting in Paris. And he knew he wanted to be a writer, but he just wasn't sure what he was going to write about or hadn't found his voice yet. So Yeats advised him to go to the Gaeltacht, to the west of Ireland, where people still spoke Irish. And you can still do this. You can go to summer school and learn Irish in the west of Ireland. It'd be a lot of fun. So he did that, and he spent several summers in the Aran Islands. And Playboy of the Western World is considered to be his greatest work. When it opened at the Abbey Theater, there were riots on opening night. And you cannot get better reviews than riots on your opening. Everybody wanted to go. But you have to keep in mind, this was 100 years ago, Irish, Catholic, you know. This is what the audience objected to. They were shocked by the use of the word shift, which is a lady's undergarment. Okay, nobody showed them a shift, just the word was in the dialogue. And the implication that a young Irish woman might spend the night in with a strange man in the house unchaperoned. Only the implication. And they were booing and hissing and stamping and behaving like animals. So Yeats was there, and this is what Yeats wrote about it. As I stood there watching, Singh came and stood beside me and said, "A young doctor has just told me that he can hardly keep himself from jumping onto a seat and pointing out in that howling mob those whom he is treating for venereal disease." Which I completely believe that story. So Singh had a very Keatsian life. He had a doomed love affair when he was young, and he died from Hodgkin's disease at age 37. So that was a great loss. He had a lot of work before him. Angela's Ashes. Who has read it? Okay, if you haven't read it, why haven't you read it? You need to read this book. This was my first trip to Ireland. I had just read this book, so I went to Limerick, and I just missed him. He was on a lecture tour. He had just left Limerick like 2 days earlier. But this is one of the books I recommend to everybody across the board, especially if you're a young person. I wish I'd had this book when I was younger. I think I would have been able to appreciate everything a lot more.
Lisa, there's an audio book of him reading it that's just phenomenal.
He's wonderful.
If you like audio books,
yeah. It's like listening to Yeats, when you hear the author, see it in his accent and everything. He's actually American because he was born in Brooklyn, but they re-immigrated or unimmigrated or whatever. They went back to Ireland when he was just a child, and then eventually he came back. So if you have ever felt poor, if you've ever felt that life is hard, and if you've ever felt that you were being punished for sins you're not sure you ever committed, read this book, because it will make you so thankful for everything you have. So there's a part in the book where he's talking about Cuchulainn, who is this big Irish legendary hero. He's like Paul Bunyan or Pico Spill or something like that. Big tall tale hero. So his father would tell the little boy stories about Cuchulainn. So they had just erected the statue and put it in the GPO, the General Post Office in Dublin, after the 1916 rising. So they were in Dublin for some reason, and the father's going to take the boys to see Cuchulainn, and he's all excited. So I'm going to read you this passage where they're in Dublin visiting his hero. Dad asked the driver if he'd mind going by way of the GPO, and the driver says, "Is it a stamp you want or what?" "No," says Dad. "I hear they put up a new statue of Cuchulainn to honor the men who died in 1916, and I'd like to show it to my son here, who has a great admiration for Cuchulainn." The driver says he has no notion of who this Cuchulainn was, but he wouldn't mind stopping one bit. He might come in himself and see what the commotion is all about, for he hasn't been in the GPO since he was a boy, and the English nearly wrecked it with their big guns firing up from the Liffey River. If you go to Dublin, if you go to the GPO, he's still there, by the way. You can still see him. There's always a man outside the GPO. He's of a certain age. He's been drinking, and he wants to show you the bullet holes. It's always a different man, but he is always there every time that guy's there, so you can see it. He says you'll see the bullet holes all over the front, and they should be left there to remind the Irish of English perfidy. I ask the man, "What's perfidy?" And he says, "Ask your father." And I would, but we're stopping outside the big building with columns, and that's the GPO. Ma'am stays in the motor car while we follow the driver into the GPO. "There he is," he says. "There's your man, Cuchulainn." And I can feel tears coming because I'm looking at him at last. Cuchulainn, there on his pedestal in the GPO. He's golden, and he has long hair, and his head is hanging, and there's a big bird perched on his shoulder. The driver says, "Now what in God's name is this all about? What's this fellow doing with the long hair and bird on his shoulder? And will you kindly tell me, mister, what has this to do with the men of 1916? Dad says, "Cuchulainn fought to the end like the men of Easter week. His enemies were afraid to go near him until they were sure he was dead. And when the bird landed on him and drank his blood, they knew." "Well," said the driver, "'tis a sad day for the men of Ireland when they need a bird to tell them a man is dead." And actually, in this statue, he is dead. This is his dying moment, and he's exhausted and he's wounded, and he can no longer stand on his own. So he tells his men to lash him to this tree so he could still, hold his sword and fight a little bit longer. But they were afraid to approach him. He was so fierce. They were afraid. They were afraid he might jump up, you know, one more time like Freddy Krueger and get him. So until they were absolutely certain he was dead, they would not approach him. Okay, Dermot Healy. In the West. He is mainly recognized for his poetry. He's won lots of awards for it. But his novel, A Goat Song, is how I was introduced to him. And it is the most lyrically beautiful novel, because he's a poet, probably, I have ever read. It's a haunting tale of long-lost love and all that. But it's not one bit sentimental. He doesn't do that at all. I mean, you feel it, but it's not like melodrama. So, by what magic, I am not at liberty to reveal, he is with us today, and he's going to read for you one of his poems, Mr. Healy.
If only I could get a beard like that. The Prayer. When Peggy was dying, her son leaned over to whisper the Our Father into her ear. She opened her eyes. Things must be bad, she said, that you've started praying.
And that is Mr. Healy. We're particularly glad to see him today, as he died earlier this year. He looks good for a dead man. And John B. Cain, who's one of my all-time favorite writers, he died probably about 10 years ago. So unlike Singh and Yeats and some of these other Anglo-Irish, he is a man of the people. He's Celtic, he's Irish, he lives among the people that he writes about. He was a publican in Listowel, County Kerry, all his life. He never stopped his day job to be a writer, and he wrote a lot. He wrote a lot of short stories. He wrote The Field, if you've seen that film with Richard Harris and Brenda Fricker and Sean, I mean, everybody's in it. It's a wonderful film. And Richard Harris was nominated for an Oscar for his performance. He is down home and earthy, but he's not like homespun. Not like the Waltons, you know? I mean, he talks about things. So the Chastitute was playing when I was in Dublin, and it's like, if you can imagine, the 50-year-old virgin, but Irish. It is so, so funny. And the guy who played it was Mick Maloney or something, who's like a big Irish actor there. So his stories have everything in them. Love, loss, they're hysterically funny, they're utterly tragic, everything you can imagine. And just from watching people, you know, across the bar, people that he knew personally. Letters of a Love-Hungry Farmer are letters from a matchmaker, which you can still find a matchmaker if you look hard enough, and a seer. In a lot of villages you can find them. So this guy is not really lying, but he's trying to put people in their best possible light. He's trying to marry off the most unmarriageable people you can imagine on the earth. So he's, you know, he'll talk up your good points and try to make you sound a little better than you are. It's very, very funny. Okay, Belfast. This is Belfast City Hall, which when I went to that conference on peace and conflict, it was like a group of faculty, and we were taken there to have tea with the mayor. You know, it was really nice. It is a beautiful, beautiful building. So we're going to visit Brian Friel and Seamus Haney. And has anybody heard of Brian Friel? Huge, huge name in Ireland. He's been called the Irish Chekhov, but he has absolutely no airs or pretensions. He's just a regular guy who happens to be a brilliant writer. He has a really healthy disdain for pretentiousness of any kind. You know, he doesn't live in this lofty, you know, circle of literati. He's just a regular guy. So we had this little interview that he actually wrote, sort of a mock interview that he imagined with, and Mr. Friel is here today too. Let's give Mr. Friel which is sort of, you know, tongue-in-cheek, but it doesn't make it any less true. So when did you know you were going to be a writer?
The answer is I have no idea.
What other writers influenced you most strongly?
I have no idea.
Which of your plays is your favorite?
None of them.
Which of your stories?
most of them embarrassment.
So you think the atmosphere in Ireland is hostile or friendly to the artist?
I'm thinking of my lunch.
So do you see any relationship between dwindling theatrical audiences all over the world and the fragmentation of what we might call the theatrical thrust into disparate movements like the theater of cruelty, tactile theater, nude theater, theater of despair? Or would you say, Mr. Friel, that the influence of Heidegger is only beginning to be felt in the drama and that Beckett and Pinter are John the Baptist of a great new movement?
Well, in answer to that, I'd say that I'm a middle-aged man, that I tire easily, and that I'd like to go out for a walk now.
And that's Mr. Friel. Rhymes with real, which is what he is. And Seamus, of course, you've all heard his name. He was born in County Derry, in the North or Londonderry, if you're a unionist, and he won the 1995 Nobel Prize in Literature, along with just about every other major literary award you could name. He died in 2013. And I have one final portion. We good on time, Ken? Where are you? All right. One final portion I want to include that's called That Is So Irish. Not particularly literary, but things are different in Ireland. Things don't always work like they do at home. And if you just relax and enjoy it, it'll be okay. No one will die. It's just a little different. But the only adjective you can use to describe them is Irish. It's just so Irish. So, this is a mummified cat and mouse, which I believe they call Tom and Jerry. Now, where would you imagine this would be? What kind of building would this be in?
Parliament.
This is in Christchurch Cathedral. And I can't remember now if it's upstairs or down, but you know when you walk into the cathedral, every slab of stone is somebody's tombstone, right? The bishops and the noblemen and everything. And so they found these guys in the catacombs in the basement, and they thought, why not? Well, let them have their little day in the sun. So they put this little glass case, and they put Tom and Jerry. You would not see that in an American church, I don't think. So that shows we have a sense of humor, even in church, even in death. We laugh about everything, because it's going to happen to all of us. Might as well just relax, right? I love that. That is so Irish. Its signage is very Irish sometimes. Why not? Why not? And I didn't notice this when I took it, but there actually is one right there in the background. I didn't see. Why not? We might need this. We could learn from this. This is the first trip. It was a walking tour of the West and the islands. July, we were freezing to death in July. I had every item of clothing I brought with me, I think, at one point on. And it's not so much the rain, it's that wind. It just slaps you in the face all day when you're out there walking 10 hours. Yeah, it's cold. It is cold in July. So we didn't anticipate that. We knew that it would be wet. We just didn't know it would be cold and wet. But like I said, this is the Gaeltacht in the West where you can learn Irish if you've a mind to, if you just have a summer to spend. And it's a lot of fun. We talked to some of the people that were there in school when we were on our tour. And they said, you fish and you swim if you're really hardy, because the water is also freezing cold. And you learn Irish and you walk around and you talk to people, and that's your summer. That would be awesome. So I don't actually understand or speak any Irish, but I just kind of like to hear it sometimes. So on television, you can watch the evening news and like a couple sort of primetime soap operas in Irish. So I like to just, you know, turn it on, have it on in the background. So I was in my hotel in Dublin, which is the George Friedrich Handel Hotel, and it's built on the site where the Messiah was first performed. In Europe, I believe. So, and it's right around the corner from Christchurch. Great location. So I go to turn on the TV. Look closely. What do you not see? On the buttons.
Like numbers?
Yeah, numbers, letters, nothing, erased. It's just, they're all blank. This was my remote control in my hotel room with nothing on it, right? So what do you do? You don't complain about this, because if you complained, you would just get, I mean, this is not a problem in Ireland, okay? This is not a problem at all. If you complained, you would just really get a look of pity, like, are you feeble-minded or what? You can't figure that out. The red thing is power. The numbers go like that. Just a little added entertainment. I don't even know how that could happen. You know, like sometimes the ones you use the most get rubbed off, and it's like every one of them was just blank. And they don't have another one in the back with numbers on. Just deal with it. Irish. Okay, and we just have time for a blessing. Okay. And now we have time for questions, which I will try to answer.
Who's your favorite one of these murders?
Oh, I knew somebody would ask that. I really, really like John Kane. He's just, because he's one of them. You know, he's folksy, but he's not in any way, another word I'm trying to say. He tells everything, but instead of Brendan Behan, who uses sometimes really crude languages, he tells it in a very charming way that we can all understand. And he's always talking about common human experience. And not some sort of lofty, you know, something that we can all relate to. Yeah.
You keep referring to the languages, Irish language, and not Gaelic.
Yeah. It's before I ever went there, I used to say Gaelic too, but the Irish people say Irish because Gaelic is more like a family of languages. So all the Celtic countries or communities have their own version. So in Cornwall, it's Cornish. In Wales, it's Welsh. In Ireland, it's Irish. Scots sometimes call it Scottish, sometimes Gaelic. Isle of Man was another place, that's Manx. But they're all dying. And officially, Ireland has two national languages, English and Irish. But that's what's the interesting thing. This is a street map of Dublin. Absolutely useless. I always buy a street map, but that doesn't necessarily relate to what you see on the street. So there might be a sign that says Bishop Street. It might be in English. It might be in Irish. It may have fallen down. It might be on a post. It might be on a building. I mean, there's no standardization. So street map just makes you look like a confused American. So I figured out how to navigate by spires. So Christchurch is here, and that's where my hotel is, and this is St. Patrick's, and it works beautifully. And I really don't need a street map. And you talk to people that way. You stop and ask directions. They say, now you go, you know, like in The Quiet Man, when John, when he's trying to get direction, now you see that road. Now that'll do you no good at all. Don't take that road, you know, like that. But it's wonderful, because that's how you get to know people.
How about relations and views of of the United Kingdom now, are they improving, or the Irish view of the British?
How the Irish feel about the British?
Yeah. Any change?
You can go, that same guy that's outside the GPO that wants to point out the bullet holes to you, he will tell you about 800 years of British perfidy and, you know, everything. I mean, they all know the story. They all know the story. But the British, there's a lot of Irish people who went to England, just like they came to America. A lot of British people work there, you know, back and forth. It's much easier transportation, communication. So you still will find people who will say, I absolutely hate the English. But I think it is a little bit better now. Yeah.
I take it GPO's not government printing office.
General Post Office.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. Oh, you did say that.
Post Office, yeah. Sure. And that statue is still there. So you can get, the first time I went, he was on loan to Belfast. So I wasn't able to see him. But I got to see him the second time. Other questions?
Just a comment. Oh, excuse me. Frank McCourt came to WKU several years past,
mm-hmm.
and before even Van Meter was renovated, and I think some people were kind of shocked at his language.
Yeah.
He's very earthy,
and he, you know, that's how street kids in Limerick talked. You know, they were that's just how it was. And if you don't want to know what life was really like, why are you reading it? Honestly, I mean, that's I like writers like that. I want to hear the truth, but sometimes it hurts.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anybody else?
Other new up and coming
kind of really young generation, other than a couple of people you met?
There are, well, I don't know, they're not really young anymore. There was a, there's a book called Yeats is Dead. Has anybody read that? These are like, these are pretty established writers. Each, they gave each writer a chapter. And the story is that someone discovers Yeats' body, and it's a mystery, and each one writes one chapter. And in, but if, was it in, I think not in isolation, but sequentially. So you would see the guys before you, and then you would go off that. And there's also another one called Finbar's Hotel, which is a collection of short stories all by different, pretty contemporary, it was probably 10 years ago though, Dublin, Jennifer Johnston, and the guy with the, you know, the commitments, Neil, Roddy Doyle, Neil Jordan, you know, all those guys. And it was, it's hysterically funny. And then they did a sequel called Ladies Night at Finbar's, which is all the female writers, Ann Enright and Jennifer Johnston and someone else. But yeah, it's such a rich cultural tradition of storytelling that there are always, you know, new ones coming up.
This is the first time that you just said you mentioned anything about female writers. Female writers are awesome.
Right.
But where's all the women?
I knew somebody would ask that. I suspected it might be a woman. So, like I said, I left out a lot of my favorite writers. But among them are not Irish women writers. I'm sorry. I can't articulate why. I've read them, but they're just not among my favorites for whatever reason. But there are more than there used to be, certainly. I mean, in every country you can name, every literature has few. I mean, the women, you know, within that are very few. And that's certainly true in Ireland. But Evan Boland is probably her most distinguished poet. Ann Enright is contemporary. But some of them I just I actively dislike. I can't help it. I don't know. I don't get on with them, I guess. Anybody else?